fishing vessels, brand new, that they can launch out into the deep again to try and go find those fish through which they could feed their children, not just feed their bellies, but also fuel their imaginations and their futures by being able to send them to school again. These are the ways that the future is breaking forth.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen, and we are back to our regular episodes. Really looking forward to these conversations as well. And yeah, we have a tremendous guest, and I'm delighted that he's here. But as always, he will introduce himself. Jamie, please go ahead.
Hey, Maurice, it's good to be with you on Walk, Talk, Listen, and I'm so relieved that I get to sit here in a comfortable chair, not having to be on a 100-mile trek. So great to do that
in the future, though, Jamie. Okay. Yeah, we will walk together. Yeah,
I will condition myself. But I have the privilege of serving as a global co-director of World Renew, together with my colleague, my partner in crime, Carol Bremer Bennett,
who has been on this show as well. So people, yes, who are interested should go back, I think, more than a year. But we interviewed her as well, so that's great and wonderful to have you now, Jamie. Yeah.
So it's great to be on your show. Our organization really is involved in helping come alongside local communities, mm-hmm, and individuals around the world, helping them rewrite the story of poverty in, mm-hmm, their communities. We just want to accompany them on that sojourn, on that journey. Ensuring that they're equipped with the tools, the resources, the platforms to be able to advocate for themselves and make a brighter tomorrow for themselves, their children, and the society around them.
Mm. And I don't think you mentioned it, right? You're based in Canada, right?
That's right. Yep. Yeah. My office is in Burlington, Ontario, mm-hmm, and that's where I'm a Canadian myself.
Okay. So tell us, where were you born and raised?
Mm-hmm. I was born in London, Ontario, in the same hospital my kids would want you not to know, as later Justin Bieber would be born in. So okay. He got all the singing talent, as it may be. And that's where I'm from, is London, Ontario, Canada.
Mm. So you were born there, but also raised. You grew up. Tell us a little bit about that. My listeners will be interested in, you know, how did you get from your birth to ultimately become a director of an NGO? So, yeah, take us through that story.
Yeah. Well, I guess there'd be kind of two maybe parallel tracks I could, mm-hmm, take your listeners on a journey with me together on, which would be, the first would be my mom's story. Mm. My mom, who now is 79 years of age and has just come through a double bypass heart surgery and sprung herself out of the hospital as soon as she could, and she's a vibrant force for good. And but she had a very rough childhood. Her family emigrated from Eastern Europe during a time of great conflict and tumult, and found themselves as immigrants in this new strange land in Canada, Southern Ontario, and life was hard. There was the language barrier, there was the lack of the livelihood, the property that was left behind, and they had to start over from scratch. And it was a very large family. were 13 children who survived infancy, and beyond one of the siblings actually died at about 4 years of age.
Mm.
And they were desperately poor. They lived four or five to a bed. They were sometimes in and out of care, foster homes and whatnot. Not because my parents didn't care for them, but because they were really trying to survive. Sadly, my grandfather was a pretty mean alcoholic, a wonderful man when he wasn't drunk.
Mm.
But when he was drinking, he was quite violent and drank away a lot of whatever the meager means the family had to live on. Mm. So my grandmother had to teach my mom and some of her siblings how to slip into the general store in their local small town, really village, and sneak provisions underneath their skirts and dresses to have enough clothing to make it through the winter, enough supplies to put on the table. And there was this woman, she and her husband, we affectionately call her now Grandma Chicas, who herself, they were immigrants themselves, but they had this small general store, and they were very generous. And they would offer to take my mom and her siblings to church, and to do so according to the order of the day. You know, you needed to be in your Sunday best, which my mom and her siblings didn't have. And so they provided them with new dresses and with new shoes, and, you know, just wanting to really express that sense of, You matter. You're worth something.
Mm.
And one Sunday morning, my grandfather, I'm not sure whether he was more loaded or the shotgun was, but he waved them off with his weapon at the doorstop, saying, don't come get my kids, you know, sort of thing. But my mom and her siblings really wanted to go to this church. So they showed up the next Sunday, but a little farther down the lane, outside of Buckshot, if you will. Picked up my mom and her sisters mostly, and they went to church. Years later, my mom was following, you know, the teachings of Jesus, and was really had this heart that was pretty sorrowful for how she had been stealing all those years ago when she was a child from this kindly family that was just loving on them and taking them to church. So she went back to her hometown. And she found Mrs. Chicas. She said, "Grandma Chicas, I need to say sorry to you. The whole time that you were being so kind to us, taking us to church, giving us dresses and shoes, that whole time we were stealing from you." And Grandma Chicas, with what I can only imagine was a twinkle in her eye, smiled and kind of shook her head and said, "That's okay, sweetie. We knew that all along. Jesus just told us to love you." And to me, I think that those are probably the seeds of the story that became my story, because I didn't grow up knowing poverty. I mean, we were not, you know, particularly affluent. You know, my dad had a small print shop that he worked so many hours a week trying to keep a roof over our head. And my mom was a school teacher. And, but, you know, I didn't lack the necessities of life. And I realized that you roll the geographic dice again, you do the DNA lottery again, and I could be born into a situation in the midst of conflict. I could be a child in Gaza right now, or in the gang warfare in Haiti right now. And would that there would be a Grandma Chicas to come alongside and to look beyond everything, to get beyond whatever I might, however I might come across and appear, and see the beauty and the dignity inside, and just try to make that linkage and to show that I might matter. And that's how I want to live my life, a life that's just in love with others, and that affords people the dignity that God has bestowed upon them, that God has breathed them into existence, the destiny that they have to accomplish to do some good in the world. Everybody should be afforded that shot. And so for me, that kind of got me, I think, on a journey of meaning and exploration, and just trying to somehow, imperfectly as I can, try to love others like I've been blessed to be loved.
And thanks for sharing this story, Jamie. Do you still remember how old you were when you heard that story? I assume that your mom told you the story.
Yeah, I was a child. I'm sure the first time I heard it was, I was probably, I would say, 6, 7, 8 years of age. Because my parents were always very real about their experience. They were very humble. We went to church not because we thought we were holier than thou, but because we knew we needed God, we needed each other, and we needed community and family. And so I believe that she would have told me at quite a young age. I don't remember ever being without that story and that motif.
Yeah. And I understand why that story, you know, was and still is important to you. But did that then also influence the choices that you made in terms of your education? Did you already have in mind, like, okay, now I want to, you know, work for an NGO, or, you know, and doing something about poverty? Or how did that develop? Because I, as you know, we talked about this earlier. A lot of younger listeners, they always ask, you know, in terms of how do you ultimately get involved with this work? How does that come about?
I don't know that I was ever that strategic or perhaps even that altruistic. I think for me, I did, even on the playground as a youngster, I remember my neighbor kid, he was getting picked on by the toughest kid in the school, who, you know, we knew had like knives, and he had a bike gang. It wasn't a motorcycle gang. It was a BMX bike gang. And I remember these kids were harassing this kid who was my next door neighbor. And I was new to school, but I just couldn't believe they were picking on this little kid. The kid was pretty yippy, pretty mouthy, you know, maybe not unlike myself. Sadly, to this day, some might say. But I just, you know, stood up for this kid, and not knowing the power dynamics at play and not knowing who the other kids that were picking on him were. And, apparently that kid had picked a fight with the big gang leader's, little brother. And the end result was, one day I found myself in a forest, where I was riding my BMX, and there were, I thought it was 50, but it was probably about, you know, a dozen kids in bicycles surrounded me out of nowhere. It was the craziest thing.
Wow.
And they started to threaten me. And I thought, uh-oh, this is it. I'm dead. I'm going to be buried in this forest, you know, as a, I don't know, 11-year-old kid or whatever it is. And I just remember, you know, saying, well, he was picking on this other kid. And this other kid was picking on him. And that guy said, well, that was my brother. So, you know, I said, oh, okay, well, but you wouldn't want your brother to be picked on, would you? I said, no. He goes, well, listen, you let me deal with my little brother. You keep your buddy out of harm's way and it'll be fine. So I guess I've always had this like sense for the underdog. So when I was thinking about school, I wanted to be a lawyer so I could fight for the underdog. I just thought, you know, I could kind of scrap my way to keep people out of harm's way. And I went that route for a bit. I ended up getting, I say God tricked me. I went to a Bible school afterwards and started to work with youth at risk in California, in a couple of churches there. And one thing led to another. I got involved in an organization that was helping advocate for children who were in context of poverty around the world, and just urging Canadians to stand with them and help them get an education and a shot at life. So years later, though, I did go back to get a master's in international human rights law, as part of some anti-trafficking work that I was later involved in. Because I guess for me, it was like one thing, sort of, I tripped over injustice in one place when I was doing some work with Compassion, a wonderful organization serving children all around the world. But I started to see kids outside of the reach of our programmatic activities who were being abused by corrupt police officials. And I knew of kids who were arrested next who were being trafficked. I don't think we even knew the term trafficking at the time. At least I didn't. But I was like, wait, this is wrong. Something needs to be done. We need to protect those kids. And yet it wasn't in the core competencies or the mandate of our organization. And if we took on the corrupt officials that were abusing these kids, our whole work for tens of thousands of kids, let's say in Haiti, might have gotten upended. And so what do you do in that context? And for me, I was like, but Jesus said that he would leave the 99 sheep in the care of the keeper and go out and find that one lost sheep that is still out there. And for me, it was the one caught in the thickets of injustice, exploitation, abuse. And so that's kind of been my journey, is just to try and get the next set of tools and form an organization or form links with others who knew more than I knew, who had better connections and contacts, who knew how to move systems and structures and leverage international legal protections, and who could move great amounts of money to shift the playing field so that, you know, the poor could be protected and uplifted and get a fighting shot at a life that we all would want for ourselves and for our children.
Right. I have two quick questions for you before we change gears. Yeah, what does your mom think about the work that you're doing? It's interesting because your father had a print shop and your mom was a teacher, school teacher, right? You said. And
Yeah. I mean, they're both. I was just with them, obviously, as my mom's recovering and coming out of the hospital. They're both really proud of both me and my brother. My brother works kind of in the print shop vein. He started doing graphic design, and then that led to IT work. And he has been doing IT troubleshooting for another organization that I was involved with. He's been doing it now for going on to 20 years with International Justice Mission. And they're super proud of the way that he is doing that. And I know that they're in my corner. And they think, hey, you're doing the right thing. Keep up the fight. You know, it's because I think they see their story a little bit reflected in the stories of those we're trying to show up for day by day. They also know that they shake their heads and are like, what is Jamie doing, this clown involved in these things that are way above his head, you know, which is true. So they pray extra hard that I don't mess things up.
Yeah. Let us talk about your present job. you're now for 2 years with World Renew or less?
Yeah, just over a year. Just over
a year. Okay.
Yeah, with World Renew.
So, you know, yeah, what is your biggest challenge at the moment within World Renew?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, there's always this interesting interplay because you think about the biggest challenge being the external geopolitical challenges, you know, trying to address world hunger or gender inequality. And these things are the things that matter. You know, the day-to-day trying to help an organization that's been around for six decades. We're 61, 62 years of age now, to try and help it lean into and lay a hold of this amazing purpose that people before I got here had built out something called, they went through a strategic planning process called Reimagine. And through that planning process, I would say the outcome has been Imagine More. And as we look at the needs around food security for millions upon millions of people around the world today, as we look at the, you know, still the endemic levels of gender inequality and how that traps women and girls to living lives less than what they are capable of or really entitled to. You know, we also need to push the edges of the ways in which we do things. So we're trying to become future ready and fit for purpose. And so it's about trying to reach out and engage with, as we did last week at the United Nations, with policymakers, with governments, with political stakeholders, with religious leaders, to say that girls matter, that women matter. In fact, it's not just an equity or an equality thing. This is a, if you want to impact your GDP, if you want to, you know, increase the vitality and the vibrancy of your workforce, if you want to see economic prosperity, if you want to see the flourishing of peace, you know, really, we need to see more women and girls in the driver's seat of transformational change, because they just have proven track records when given that opportunity to create a better community, a better society, better outcomes in business, and you know, when you see women getting a small loan in a village, the entrepreneurial spirit with they use that to start a mobile little coffee business that goes around to weddings and funerals, and almost like an Uber cafe, if you will, but in the, you know, in the island of Madagascar, because they're fighting for their children's future. They do things so innovatively and so entrepreneurially and so with such a fighting spirit that transformation is not only possible, it really is breaking in upon us. It makes me think of Arundhati Roy, who said, hope is not only possible, but on a quiet day, another day is not only possible, but on a quiet day, I can almost hear her breathing. So these are the challenges, to see that there are systems and structures that get in the way. There are bureaucracies that are inefficient. There are organizations that were designed to serve the poor that become self-perpetuating. And so sometimes we have to turn the tables and upend things and give voice and agency and advocacy, the microphone, the platform to those in the local communities and listen to their solutions and their ingenuity. And as Bruce Coburn put it, you know, we got to kick at the darkness until it bleeds daylight. And I think that's beginning to happen. But it feels like some days the tide reverses course. And like we saw with the, you know, rise of COVID, the poverty clock turned backwards and hundreds of millions of people had to start afresh. Or when there's a disaster that breaks in. This morning I was in a board meeting with some of our friends, those leading on the board of World Renew Philippines. And they had a super typhoon come through about a year ago. And the aftermath of that was that not only were people's shelters ripped away from them, but the kiosks that they sell their wares in, the small little fishing vessels, all destroyed. So their means of production is destroyed. But even if they had a few, you know, pigs or chickens that they used to try to grow to sell in the marketplace, they had to consume them to stay alive. And so all the means of production are gone. And now they're living out exposed to the elements. And so to come back in and help them restart their lives and to put some good roofing over their heads, with them doing the manual labor together with some you know, trained carpenters and masons and whatnot, or to see them with a fleet of like 50, you know, basically canoe fishing vessels, brand new, that they can launch out into the deep again to try and go find those fish through which they could feed their children, not just feed their bellies, but also fuel their imaginations and their futures by being able to send them to school again. These are the ways that the future is breaking forth.
That's Great. Thanks, Jamie. What I really appreciate, and I know the listeners also, is that what you did just did is you not only talked about the challenges within that an organization might face, but also bring it back to, you know, what it at the end is all about, you know, about the transformation in the communities where we work. And I just have to let the listeners know that if they did not listen to two of your colleagues who I interviewed during the last weeks, the Commission on the Status of Women 68, Esther and Catherine, they should check out that podcast episode, you know, a shameless promotion of this podcast, but I think it's really worthwhile.
Yes.
I would, as I said, after two questions, I would change gears. What I would like to do is remind you, I know you might not want to do it, but we will in the future. This particular podcast is a spin-off of a 100-mile walk that I started to do in 2012, where I hope, you know, try to raise awareness and funds for on hunger, poverty, and injustice. And then during COVID, I was not able to walk with others. So I started this virtual walk, which has gone out of hand, but okay, we're still doing it. If I would ask you to walk 100 mile in a week, so that means 15 to 20 miles a day, for which cause would you do that? And why?
That is a great question. My silence is not only because I'm dreading thinking of lacing on my hiking boots to, you know, not even 100 kilometers. You're saying 100 miles. So, you know, I want to count the cost. But the reality is, you know, the causes you mentioned, hunger. One of the reasons I joined World Renew is because with the looming hunger crisis. I mean, I've been to Somalia. And I've seen the menace of starvation. I've seen its impact. And I don't want to be macabre, but I've met with families who, I met with a father who had lost every single of like the 30 head of cattle, every bit of livestock he had dropped in the drought. And four of his seven children perished as they were trying to migrate across hostile, you know, militant lines to get to the city of Baidoa, also known as the city of death, because at one point 260,000 people perished in the first famine since the 1984 famine that we all think of, the Ethiopian famine. And hunger just should not exist in our day, like not the endemic levels of starvation, hunger being used as a weapon of war. I think maybe today I would say that is probably what I would strap on for and walk, and with each step just hopefully trample upon something of the injustices that are used, because famine in and of itself, sometimes we think it's a natural phenomenon because of the lack of water, lack of drought. And of course, we know that that relates to climate change. And there's, you know, there's different, obviously, factors that we have an impact and influence on. But other times it's policy that diverts water away from certain places to other places. Other times it's used actually as a weapon of war, like a siege to starve certain people out that are deemed the other because they're a different ethnicity or tribe or people group or ideology. And when you deny someone their fundamental human right to, you know, to water that is, of course, the source of sustenance to grow any crops that would help a child be fed, that would give a mother enough nourishment that she would have enough to be able to lactate and nurse her baby at her breast. When you deprive that fundamental human condition, there's something evil afoot. So this is not just a cause that's out there in some cosmic way. This is a This is a really it is a conflict between good and evil that needs people of goodwill to rise up and do something.
I know, well, no, let's put it this way. When I listen to you, hunger is part of you know, a system that needs to change, you know, injustice that needs to be solved. I do think that the world has come up with how we are going to solve this. And we identified 17 sustainable development goals. And, you know, different things need to happen. You know, goal one, end poverty, goal two, end hunger, goal five, gender justice. So, you know, I always want my listeners to know that these sustainable development goals exist. I know you are very familiar with it. World Renew is working on them. But my question to you is, what do you exactly want the listeners to know about the sustainable development goals? And then my second part of the question is, I do think that one of the reasons that we are only at 15% on average in reaching those sustainable development goals before 2030 has to do is that we did not pay proper attention to the ability, skills, and knowledge that you need as an individual and as well as community. And a growing group of people came up with the inner development goals. I also know that you heard about those. So I would like to hear from you your thoughts on the inner development goals and, you know, what do you think there, you know, the listeners should know about? So two things, SDGs as well as IDGs.
I think I might take a bit of a counterintuitive approach here, because I do think the SDGs are important, as were the MDGs before them. And I think that we got a lot of progress through the Millennium Development Goals. As you mentioned, we're barely scratching the surface on the SDGs. And I don't want that to mesmerize us into inaction. But I was watching a little bit on the inner development goals and how, you know, one person kind of went from the abstract, you know, that some of these challenges are caused by, you know, climate change and loss of biodiversity and such things. And he said, that's what I used to think, but I was wrong. I think now it's about greed. And it's about, you know, they just were bringing it down to the visceral human experience. And I would say, for me, if you could boil it down to one cause that you care about, passionate about, that you're going to be ruthless and relentless about, whether it's, you know, gender equality and working to see the transformation of that, if you are passionate about hunger, to throw yourself, you know, tooth and nail into addressing that as a matter of justice, and skill yourself up in that way and become a fearless, tireless advocate for that. There is a need for generalists who can see the interdependencies and the integration of all of these. And at a global systems level, of course, these things need to intersect and work together. But sometimes I think that's so big and grandiose that you know, an everyday person like me doesn't know exactly what to do with it. But learn one story. Find out about one child who's been caught in injustice, a child that's been abused or exploited, and think how, what led to that atrocity coming home to them. That's going to be something that could be a spark that might sustain you through the fight, because it's so easy to get apathetic or get just throw up your hands and go, it's too big, I don't know what to do about it. So it is what I like about the inner development goals. For me, you know, a lot of this goes back very simply to, you know, Jesus, when he was had the disciples, you know, falling around and him and they saw that people were getting hungry, and this isn't like famine level hunger. This was just, you know, they were starting to get hungry, and they probably were people who didn't get much more than a meal or two a day. And the disciples were like, we better send them away or there's going to be a riot. You know, things could get, they're going to get hangry. And Jesus said, you give them something to eat. And they're like, what are you talking about? We don't have anything. We didn't bring provisions. And then they went and they found this little boy who had one lunch that his mom lovingly prepared. And Jesus said, okay, bring that to me. Give me what's in your hands. And then he blessed it and he broke it and people were filled. I think if we would take whatever it is that we have to offer on one of these goals and share something of what we have, a bit of our time and energy instead of doom scrolling, you know, endlessly, say, okay, where could I make one difference? Where could I send a tweet out that might encourage somebody to think about something in a new way? Where could I start learning about something? And maybe if I'm a student, I could try and do a speech that will call some attention to it or something small, like a little, you know, bake sale or whatever it might be. You know, do a TikTok that'll raise awareness about something that you could actually make some positive impact in the world. I think we start in those small places, the ripples emanate outward. We want to wait until we can, you know, have our PhD in something and, you know, cure cancer. But we, you know, despise the small beginnings. Well, start with that one seed maybe that you have and water it and learn from there. Touch, you know, the life of maybe it's mentoring a kid in school near you or listening to them as they're struggling with their journey of being a new, you know, a new Canadian, a new American, an immigrant or a refugee, and get to know them, have lunch with them and try and understand what their world is like. And you might see that you're not much different than them and that they've got ideas and imagination and a story to tell that will transform your life and engage you in a life of meaning beyond anything you've ever imagined.
Okay. No, I appreciate, but if I understand you well, I heard you say, you know, of course we need, you know, people that are working on changing the system, you know, as a whole, making it more fair.
Absolutely.
But some of us are overwhelmed and then, you know, don't do nothing, but, you know, do something that you can, you know, yeah, which you can comprehend. And that's important as well. I really appreciate that. I would like to go, because you mentioned, you know, religion, you know, Jesus a lot when you speak. Actually, when I walk with a co-walker, I call them, you know, somebody who accompanies me on the 100-mile walk for an hour or half a day, we talk about, you know, they ask me, why do you do this? And I ask myself the question, you know, why am I doing this, right? But what is the purpose? And they end up talking about religion, about spirituality, talking about that the younger generation seems to do, at least in some parts of the world, different. They don't go to churches often or not at all. What do you see happening among youth in your community?
That's a good question. I mean, I imagine that you know, youth may not go to church in traditional ways because they don't know if it has anything of meaning or relevance to them. And maybe they feel like their questions aren't answered there or not even encouraged. You know, I think if our houses of worship are places of rules and regulation and thou shalt nots, then, I mean, kids have enough of that at school and in home. Like, what do they want? But if they're places of, like, that are raging with a fire for justice, that are inflamed with a concern for all humanity. You know, I think of, you know, we often talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., rightly so. And we forget that he was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. And that so much of what he was about was part and parcel of the outworking of his Christian faith. And he would walk in solidarity with, you know, people of a Jewish faith background. He would look at, you know, perhaps what what Malcolm X was doing, informed by some of, you know, his ideals, informed by Islam. I think that the universe is bleeding. Our world is bleeding. And, you know, science, technology, it has some superficial solutions, but it's not going to get to the deep aching of, you know, the horrors of racial discrimination, or people who've been torn apart in conflict, or man's inhumanity to man, to use the ancient language. You know, there are certainly technological solutions, but you know, we need to be able to leverage, you know, again, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the need for both the law and religion, or education as well, when he talked about lynching. You know, lynching, of course, was a horrific reality that still happens on occasion. But in the deep U.S. South, there were songs talking about the strange fruit, and that would be men's bodies hanging suspended from trees because others deemed them worth less and deemed them those that could be beaten and condemned and treated profanely. And but Martin Luther King Jr. said, you know, the law may not make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me. And I think that's pretty important. So I think that there are different streams in society, both our religious faith, our academic enterprises, our scientific endeavors, that when fused together, we can maybe have bandages that will wrap around the heart, the soul, as well as the body and the mind. Mm. And when I look at youth that I engage with, largely through my kids these days, they have just a very real experience living in the, you know, the real world of kids trying to make it through. They're running a pretty tough gauntlet on social media, and people being picked apart, and people being canceled, and people being attacked. And, you know, they're in a very adult world where they're exposed to all the horrors of the world at their fingertips, and all of the glamour and the prestige and the affluence all at the same time. And it's really, really hard. No wonder we have a mental health crisis. Really hard for them to reconcile these worlds and to think that they can do anything about it. But I've seen my kids step into spaces just gently of solidarity with others, where, you know, my son, when he looks at his friends, largely Muslim friends, going through Ramadan, and he learns about it, and he even, you know, at times has fasted during Ramadan, not because he's Muslim, but because he wants to support his friends and what's important to them. And I think building those bridges and bonds, human to human, and asking the deeper questions about faith and meaning, you know, I think that it helps us go a little deeper than the superficial, commodified, candified, confected solutions that really the world just wants to sell, that don't actually meet our deeper feelings of rejection or alienation. And so I don't think I have an easy answer on this, but when I think about another tree, you know, that Jesus died on, here was a God that exposed himself to all manner of inhumanity and allowed himself to enter into the torment and be abused and exploited and spit upon, not for having done anything wrong, but for have opposed the any systems around that would oppress another. I think that that causes us to pause, rather than to walk, talk, and listen, to pause, to reflect, and to wonder, what do we got going on in our world when we've got people killing each other in the name of religion, killing each other in the name of territorial boundaries, carving up neighborhoods, communities, and people for power sake, whether it's gangs or organized games of political systems that just demonize the other. Can we open our hands and outstretch them to try and help one person out of a tough spot they're in and maybe enlarge our humanity step by step by step? That's what the civil rights movement did. That's what the transatlantic slave, abolitionist movement did. And that's what's happening with so many of the movements that you feature on your show. People opening their hands instead of a clasp, instead of a fist, opening their hands to another and maybe upwards, saying, heaven help us. But we're going to get on with the business of sowing some seeds here on this earth.
No, thanks, Jamie, for that. And thanks for referring also to, the fact that I have been able to talk with a lot of awesome people on this podcast coming from different walks of life. And I hope by connecting, my guests with the listeners, but also my guests with other guests, at least not only symbolically, but really, connections will occur that people think, I might not have agreed with 75% of what this person said, but there's 25%. That's interesting. And the person is actually closer to me than I thought, or is more in common. So, I have always a question of the previous guest for you as well, for my present guest as well. And this is the question.
If you were given the opportunity to empower someone to live their dream, what would you say to them to motivate them to go for it?
Yeah, I think I would obviously, it would be defined by the nature of my relationship with them and my understanding of them. But I imagine if it's coming from a place of authentic passion, I'd say pay attention to that. That's rare. There's something in there that needs releasing, that needs investing into the society that we're in. And if that's been implanted in you, like, sow that seed, put it out there, get after it. Because, you don't want to come and go and let your time pass and you've had no impact. Maybe nothing will happen, but my guess is you put it out there and you're going to see something sprout. You're going to see a spark that starts something, and just get after it. Start as soon as you can to do something practical and real and see where that journey takes you.
Right. Your question for the next guest.
Do I know who the next guest is, or is this just
no.
kind of out into the ether?
I do, but I never tell it.
What one thing have you found it's been the most important for you to unlearn in order to see and be a bit different in the world, the way you want to be, rather than the way you've always been, or it's always. What do you want to unlearn, or what are you unlearning?
I have a couple of questions that I would like to ask you, to answer a little bit faster. So bear with me. I always have a question about music, because for me, music is really important. You were alluding to mental health. For me, definitely music is a
therapy.
So exactly. Yeah. So if I ask you to come up with a song or a piece of music that best embodies for a big part who you are, who Jamie is, which song or piece of music would it be and why? And we will add that song to a playlist that's out there on Spotify. hashtag Walk Talk Listen, all the songs that have been selected by my guests you can find.
Yeah. Oh, there's many, but one would be U2's Pride in the Name of Love.
Mm-hmm.
Just this relentless sense that another world is possible if we'll stand for our ideals. It might tear us up, but it's worth contending for something better in this world. Mm-hmm. Another lyric that could lead to the song is Leonard Cohen, forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. Oh, ring the bells that still can ring. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Because I'm a pretty flawed guy. I don't have it all figured out. I have more questions than answers most days. And if I get stuck, sometimes I spin and I'm just like, I don't know what solution is here. And is it making a difference? And who am I anyways? Because I'm just as messed up as the next person. But if I'll just get over myself and realize I'm flawed, I'm just a vessel. But you know what? There's a crack in everything. Let's do our best and let God let that light shine through. Those big gaps.
Awesome. Steve Hartman of CBS is investigating, there's a program around one simple act of kindness and the potential to create a ripple effect. One quick question about it. Do you believe in that? What are your thoughts? And then if I ask you to come up this week with one simple act of kindness, what would you do?
Listen to someone's story. Just take the time to see when somebody is, hey, how you doing? And you see that their answer is maybe there's something more to it. And if they're willing, if the timing is right, just to gently nudge and listen. And then see if there's something practical I could do in response. And absolutely, I believe that really that is probably the majority of what we're meant to be doing is those simple, small things. That's what's been given to us. That's the stone or the seed that's been in our hand.
Okay. Jamie, these conversations always go fast. So we're almost there. But is there maybe one question that I should have asked you, but I didn't?
Yeah, maybe a question about those that inspire me, those around me.
Who would you if I force you to name one?
To name one. There are many, but I would say. I would say the female leaders that I've had the privilege to work alongside or serve under, serve alongside, serve with, they have mentored me. They have taught me ways of approaching things that are phenomenal. There's been a relentlessness, a passion, and a grace. And so two I would say is my previous boss, Allison Alley at Compassion Canada, just an amazing leader, and my current comrade in arms, Carol Bramer Bennett, who just she cares about the injustices in the world on a macro scale and individually, just cares passionately about each person right where they are, and with every breath, she's trying to make the world a better place. So. Those would be two for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie, so much for your willingness to talk with me, to share your experience, wisdom. All the best with everything you do. It's great. And thanks so much.
Thanks, brother. It's been a pleasure.
extra mile. Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.